Part 2. Good Things Come. Chapter 7. Living in Bodies. Sometimes it's easy to dive into erotic connection because the context has already made it easy to access pleasure. When our relationship is thriving, when we're relaxed and happy and healthy. Other times, when we're stressed or ill, or raising small children, or in a big fight about money. The context makes it difficult to access pleasure. Couples who sustain a strong sexual connection over the long term treat their shared context as a shared project with the goal of making it easy to experience pleasure. Here in part two, I want to help you manage the barriers you're likely to face as you put this into practice in your own relationships. If pleasure is the measure was the moral of the story of part one, the moral here is good things come. To those who wait, I mean. Co-creating a pleasure-favorable context isn't something we do in a day. Our sexuality is a garden. It has seasons. There are times when our most life-affirming choice is to harvest the fruits of our erotic connection, yes. Other days, deep in winter, the life-affirming choice is browsing seed catalogs to prepare for spring, which always comes, whether we're here for it or not. Just like pleasure, we can always cultivate change. We can never force it. We are not promised abundant time in this life, but we are promised change. The key to sustaining a strong sexual connection over the long term is to adapt with confidence, joy, and calm, warm curiosity to the changes brought by each season of our lives. Even in the face of the difficulties we'll confront in this part of the book, you and a partner can co-create a context that makes pleasure not just easier to access, but abundant and ecstatic. In this chapter, our focus is on the ways that difficult aspects of living in a body, illness, pain, disability, aging, and so on, can actually enhance an erotic connection. Let me qualify that. One time, I met a militant vegan who told me that actually, vegans have more food choices because they can eat all these plants. To which I replied, but omnivores can eat all those things and also meat and eggs and cheese. To which he replied something rude, but I forget. But basically, he got mad. I say this to illustrate that I am not someone who frames limitations as better, actually. Just because you experience a major health issue or trauma doesn't mean you automatically have access to special sex magic that you didn't have access to before. But let me revisit that conversation with the militant vegan and offer the best faith interpretation I can of his words. It's not that vegans have more choices. It's that the limitations set by their diet create a context that encourages them to explore, try new things, and embrace experiences they might have passed by before. And that's true for an erotic connection with a person whose illness, trauma, or aging changes their needs. You may not have more choices, but you do have a context that encourages you to explore. Try new things. Shed all of the preconceived ideas about how sex should work and experiment with all the ways it can and does work for you and your partners in the bodies you have right now. In this chapter, we'll apply this idea to three potentially difficult aspects of living in bodies. The changes we experience in our health status, the shame we carry from early life experiences, the trauma many of us did not choose but were forced to experience. Calm, warm curiosity. The fundamental mistake people make when they approach change is that they approach the problem from a rage space, trying to destroy it. Or they approach it from a fear space, trying to solve it by pretending it doesn't exist. Or they approach it from panic grief. When you're in panic grief, You desperately need to ensure your continued existence by repairing your relationship, or else you're lost in the darkness of helpless isolation. Trying to solve a sex problem from a panic grief space is how people begin having sex they don't necessarily want or like for the sake of salvaging a relationship. Ultimately, the reason problem solving from an adverse space is ineffective is that rage or fear or panic grief are reactive. The problem activates a stress response that motivates you to destroy or run or spiral rather than to explore, understand, and feel compassion. Seeking, by contrast, is creative. In her book, You Belong, mindfulness teacher Sebane Selassie noticed that reactive and creative are the same word with the C moved. "What does the C stand for?" a friend asked her. "Curiosity," was her answer. She writes, quote, "Curiosity is a crucial component of lessening our reactivity. Rather than react out of habit, we become interested. But how do you cultivate curiosity if you get pulled into reactions before you even know it? How can you be curious about your unconscious conditioning? How do we meet any moment with creativity instead of reactivity? Easy. We stay open to our experience." Okay, it's not that easy, but it's possible. End quote. It's possible with practice. In the language of the floor plan, staying open to our experiences is witnessing our own internal experience from observational distance. In fact, curiosity is an important tool for giving us just enough distance from our rage, fear, or panic grief to be able to find our way out of those spaces. Here is your way out. "I see you. I love you. I want to know you. Hello, problem. Hello, struggle. Hello, wound." Calm, warm curiosity is a blend of three spaces in your emotional floor plan: seeking for curiosity, care for emotional warmth, and observational distance for calmness. We begin from observational distance. I see you. When we approach a problem, our first step is to shift into our scenic viewpoint, to see the situation as if we're viewing it from the outside. When we create distance between ourselves and the problem, we can be neutral, non-judgmental of ourselves and our partner. Then, care. I love you. This is our turning toward with an urge to care for rather than correct or corral a problem. Care is a loving space from which to seek solutions. Does it seem strange to love something you want to change? Think about it this way. If a child is crying, does yelling at them to stop crying help? No. You turn toward them with love to soothe the distress. It's the same when you turn toward your own struggle. And finally, seeking. I want to know you. Moving toward, exploring. Oh, neat. What's that? What might happen if you approached your body and your partner's with calm, warm curiosity? Let's find out. Bodies vary and change. If you're lucky enough to grow old with a partner, you'll have the glorious privilege of watching them age, and granting them the glorious privilege of watching you age. To be in a long-term relationship is to be with someone as they go through times of wellness and times of disability. Stay with someone long enough, and you may well find yourself in the role of caregiver as well as lover. Lots of people have these kinds of experiences at every age. We live in bodies. Bodies are liable to damage and are inextricably tied to illness and mortality. I have friends who had cancer in their 20s and relied on their partners in relationships much shorter than mine to help them through the side effects of radiation, surgery, and chemotherapy. My sister's husband has been through a dozen surgeries, and she herself has been hospitalized multiple times and, most recently, was a COVID long hauler, experiencing chronic fatigue and pain for years after she was technically recovered from the infection. They have had to be there for each other in basic, biological ways for a large proportion of their 2 decades together. Maybe the big diagnosis comes into the relationship with you. Your partner comes into your life with a disability, chronic illness, or pain, or you come to your partner with something. A curious approach to illness or disability will help you to see the illness or disability as something separate from your partner. Your partner has needs, but they are not their needs. Stay present with your partner. See them, not just their needs. Shane and Hannah Burkaw are an inter-abled couple with a YouTube channel chronicling their experiences. Shane was born with spinal muscular atrophy. He uses a wheelchair and needs assistance with tasks of daily living. Hannah watched a documentary about him, felt they had a lot in common, and emailed him out of the blue. Shane says of that email, "She used parentheses in a way that did it for me." They often address other people's ableist assumptions about their intimate life. These comments derive from people's apparent inability to recognize that you can be a caregiver and a lover within the same relationship. It's not a sacrifice. It's not noble. It's what you do when you love someone and share a life with them for years. The couple has a sense of humor about it. In a series of question and answer videos, they use the word intimacy as a blanket term to cover all sexual behaviors, so they don't have to go into specific awkward details. But Shane invents names for fictional sex positions like Flaming Flamingo and Alabama Snake Rider. In addition to the funny parts, the pair offers deep wisdom any relationship can benefit from. When asked how they draw a line between affectionate touch and caregiving touch, they answer simply, "We don't draw a line. There is no line, not even imaginary. We just go back and forth between the two." Shane adds, "We don't say, okay, caregiving is over and let's begin the intimate touch. Caregiving will involve intimacy. Sometimes it will, sometimes it won't. Intimacy will involve caregiving here and there, like, Hannah, can you move my leg to the left? It's all intertwined and the same." Hannah offers this analogy. You can give your significant other a high five, and that's not a different relationship than when you're being intimate. In an interview, they describe their sexual connection as the kind of sex life I would wish for any couple. "Our intimacy benefits from my disability," Shane says. "It doesn't look like what you see in the movies, maybe, but like, I can totally do it." Hannah says, "In general, Shane just uses his voice in ways that other people might just physically do something. I will just say, hey, do you want to go have sex?" Shane agrees. And I know that probably strikes people as like, oh, that must be like not romantic. But like, take our word for it. After I ask that, we're romantic. When we're in bed together, I can say like, hey, can you roll me towards you? Or can you move my arm so I can reach your neck or cheek? Hannah continues, "And we have a shorthand for all these things. Like, you're not just saying, can you please put your leg up under my legs? I feel like I just know his body and preferences as well as I know my own." And there's my whole book that took me years to write, laid out in a couple of paragraphs. It doesn't look like in the movies, but we talk to each other about what we want, and we know each other's bodies as well as we know our own. Got that? That's pretty much what you need to know. Jessica Kellgren-Fozard and her wife Claudia are another interabled couple and a delightful example of caring for without falling into the trap of taking care of. Jessica has 2 genetic disorders, one affecting her nerves and the other affecting her connective tissue, together causing an array of differences and health issues, including deafness, chronic pain, migraines, chronic fatigue, and occasionally accidentally dislocating a joint or completely losing mobility in her limbs. Claudia does not have any genetic health conditions, though she is very grumpy before her morning cup of tea. Like Shane and Hannah, the couple married in their 20s, and physical challenges and accessibility were a part of their relationship from the very beginning. In a two-part video, Jessica and Claudia address the assumptions strangers make about their relationship, particularly ableist comments like, "Your wife must be an angel, you're so lucky to have her," and "Your conditions must be so exhausting for your wife." As if Jessica were a burden for a loved one to carry, rather than a person and a partner who contributes to a relationship. No, the couple clarifies, Jessica is quite a catch, actually, and they both contribute the best of themselves to the relationship. They answer questions like, if Claudia is sick or hurt or something, does she ever feel like she can't complain about it because you are still worse off? Before Jessica has even read the whole question, Claudia is already side-eyeing the camera and shaking her head. She answers no. That's a firmly resounding no. And Jessica cackles and adds, no, 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 no. In fact, they say, Jessica really loves looking after people, and Claudia really loves being looked after, regardless of the actual physical needs in the relationship. Jessica is Jessica, who loves to bake and dance, regardless of her current physical situation. And Claudia is Claudia, who loves to garden and travel, regardless of her current physical situation. While they make the entirely valid choice not to be explicit about their sex life in public, boundaries for the win, there is nothing about the way each of them looks at the other that disguises their adoration, admiration, and tenderness. They see each other, and they don't let the needs called for in a specific situation obstruct their loving gaze. Wait, isn't this a sex book? Why is this big section about pain, injury, disability, and illness in here? Friend, this is a book about sex and long-term relationships. If you're not already in an inter-abled relationship, if you stay with someone long enough, eventually you will be. I know a lot of us are used to advice about how to spice things up, but we know from the research that adding stimulation to the accelerator is only occasionally what's needed to keep a sexual connection engaged. More often, we need to eliminate the things that are hitting the brakes. And some of the things that might hit our brakes are out of our control. So instead of changing the things that hit the brakes, we change how we feel about the thing that hits the brakes, so that it doesn't hit the brakes anymore. Speaking of changes over the long term, menopause. If someone in your relationship has a uterus, menopause will probably happen at some point, whether medically induced, surgically induced, or biologically induced. While there's no specific uterus-related hormonal situation that influences your sexuality directly, lots of the changes that come with perimenopause and menopause can impact sexual functioning. Hot flashes, unpredictable menstrual cycles, changes in how your body stores fat, the fact of aging itself, gender dysphoria, all of these might hit the brakes. A stray comment from a partner about the changes to your body can activate an overwhelming cascade of feelings about yourself and about your need for support from your partner. Beyond that, reductions in estrogen can alter the lining of the vagina, making the tissue fragile, which can increase pain with both internal and external genital stimulation, which in turn can reduce sexual desire, since, again, it's difficult to want sex that hurts. Vaginal suppository medication can help with the tissue issue, but that has to be supplemented with gentleness and patience, unlearning the link between genitals and pain. Fortunately, as Gen X ages into menopause, we are rejecting medicalized and gendered ideas of what menopause means and how to experience it. Heather Corinna's book, What Fresh Hell Is This?, and Omishade Bernie Scott's multimedia Black Girl's Guide to Surviving Menopause are part of this shift, integrating intersectional, trans and non-binary inclusive social justice lenses to the endocrinology, psychology, and social experiences of menopause. Our own changing bodies and our partners don't have to hit the brakes unless we decide to hold on tight to cultural assumptions that say bodily changes and needs disqualify us from being sexual. A writer friend of mine, who was a nurse for many years, says illness creates the deepest intimacy. Giving and receiving care is the essence of our human need for connection. Caring for gathers a loved one into a supportive embrace. Caring for holds the loved one in one hand and their needs in another. Taking care of risks losing sight of our partner and noticing only their needs. Illness creates the deepest intimacy. What that intimacy does to your erotic connection depends on whether you can still see your partner as your partner through their illness, and whether your partner can still see you through yours. Margot and Henry. Margot and Henry were experiencing normal aging. Menopause, less rigorous erections, body changes like Margot's rheumatoid arthritis, and coronary artery disease for Henry, not to mention life stressors that belong exclusively to the lucky people who live long enough to experience them. Margot was a grandparent, Henry a great-grandparent, and some of their own kids and their kids' kids and their kids' kids' kids had struggles that Margot and Henry wanted to be there for. Between the physical challenges and the emotional stressors, it was no wonder Margot was feeling stuck in care, unable to relax into play or seeking. Margot harnessed some advice she remembered from a grandchild's school counselor to figure out what could help her and Henry co-create a context that made it easier to access pleasure. Four kinds of social support, Margot reviewed: instrumental, informational, emotional, appraisal. Ultra short summary for those who don't spend much time with school counselors or public health employees. Instrumental support is giving concrete aid. For example, if you're hungry, I give you a fruit roll-up. Informational support is imparting knowledge or teaching a skill. Example, you're hungry, I tell you where to find the fruit roll-ups. Or maybe I teach you how to make them. Emotional support is being there emotionally for someone in all the ways we described in the trust section. For example, if you're hungry and there's no immediate aid available, I am there for you with empathy and compassion, helping you sustain hope until a concrete solution is available. Appraisal support is offering feedback about a person or their situation in order to help them change that situation. For example, you tell me you're hungry and I, as your therapist or your best friend, suggest some characteristics in your personality or life history that are preventing you from accessing the food that would otherwise be available to you. So, Margot said, what are some things we already know make it easier to get to the sexy? Emotional support, Henry crowed. Ted Lasso of polyamory. Margot added, actual instrumental support, helping me get done all the different tasks and chores and errands. The more we can get off my plate, the easier I can walk away from my day. That's amazing, isn't it? Henry said, surprised. It didn't occur to me that the cleaning and things weren't just symbolic. They were real things that were really weighing on you. And if I just do them, it's almost like your sexual breaks have a to-do list. And if we just check some things off, your breaks are freed up enough to let the accelerator fly free. Yes. That's news to you? Okay. Thumbs up for informational support. I guess I was thinking it's the thought that counts. It's not that the thought doesn't count, but a basket full of folded laundry and an empty kitchen sink actually eliminates things that were hitting my brakes rather than just being nice about the things that were hitting my brakes. What if we pretend I'm the plumber come to fix your leaky faucet and you slide your fingers down my crack? Henry batted his eyelashes at her. Margot laughed but said, there's another level to it too. Dishes and laundry and fixing the leaky faucet are things I used to be able to do easily on my own. But lately, She stopped and rubbed at her knuckle joints, a familiar gesture to both of them. The pain hits my brakes, but more than that, it reminds me that my body is not what it used to be. I worry that I'm losing my independence. And when you can do those things for me without my even having to ask, that's emotional support and instrumental support all in one. It releases me from the difficult emotions and makes it easier for me to get to pleasure. Understanding different ways to create a supportive connection was part of their process of co-creating a context where pleasure was easy as their bodies changed. But I do want to add that they worked on the erotic context itself. Much as my husband and I put sex towels near the bed, Margot and Henry bought some supportive pillows to make various positions easier, including positions that made giving oral sex easier for both of them. They also used tools like cock rings and strokers, the short, soft silicone tubes that enclose the shaft of the penis, to make hand jobs less of a strain. And they followed the one and only prescriptive advice I give. Use lube. Not the usual drugstore kinds, the fancy pants body safe lubes you get at specialty stores or online. Since they weren't worried about using latex, Margot and Henry chose coconut oil as the most comfortable on her menopausal genitals. It's not all big feelings and conversations. Sometimes it's lubricant and pillows and pocket pussies. The Dark Places, created by shame. A lot of us have fraught relationships with pleasure. Over the course of our lives, we're likely to be shamed or judged for some parts of our sexualities. In response, we hide those parts, even from ourselves. They live in what I call the dark places, shadowy corners of yourself that you don't even want to look at. The woman in chapter 3, who was groped and then was triggered by her partner, her brain's response to the trauma was to build a trap door that opened into fear, a dark place, whenever it recognized a sensation similar to the unsafe experience. But dark places can also come from unremembered shadows cast on our infant bodies. A woman told me this story that illustrates the origin of a dark place in one person's body. She had read Come As You Are and was thinking about its message about body image and shame when she watched her brother changing his baby daughter's diaper. When the baby was clean, he reached for a fresh diaper, and when he turned back, she was touching her genitals. He scolded her, don't touch that. How might he have responded if his baby had a penis instead? Would he have scolded his child for touching those genitals? How might he have responded if his baby had been touching her feet instead? Don't we love it when babies find their feet and play with them as they explore and get to know this new body they were given? This baby will not remember this moment, but it will accumulate with countless similar moments to create a dark place in her mind. She will associate her genitals and their sensations with the experience of being scolded or punished. Her genitals make her a bad girl. By adolescence, she'll have a sense that that part of her body does not truly belong to her, that the sensations of those parts are dangerous or disgusting. Maybe her entire lust room will be dark, windowless, airless, full of unopened suitcases and dusty skeletons. And she may not even remember any explicit messages from anyone telling her to feel ashamed. Dark places make themselves difficult to find by design. Some may be disguised so that your mind just glides past them without noticing. Some may be guarded by armed and angry monsters so that your only response is to run away without even trying to explore. Sex educator Nadine Thornhill was already an expert in child and adolescent sex education when her 3-year-old son, playing in his room with a friend, was discovered by the friend's mom. The boys were showing each other their penises. The friend's mom told Nadine what happened and was very calm about it, knowing, as Nadine knew, that this kind of thing was just a normal part of being a kid. And yet, as Nadine told me, I was so ashamed and I had this visceral reaction, and I yelled at my son. But then later, I was like, what did I just do to my kid? Soon she realized, oh, I just totally got triggered and became the mean mom who yells at her 3-year-old because that's what happened to me. What happened to her? When she was 5, she was at a babysitter's house with the babysitter's 2 sons, who were about her age or a little older. They were playing in the basement when one of them said, let's all pull down our pants and look at each other. Young Nadine said, I don't want to. But the boy tried to talk her into it and eventually said, I'll go first. He pulled down his pants, and that's when his mom walked in. The mom asked her son, why are you doing that? And the boy said, Nadine wanted to do it. Did you, Nadine? Little Nadine shook her head vehemently, but the other brother chimed in, yeah, Nadine wanted to do it. So 5-year-old Nadine got dragged upstairs and sat on the couch and lectured about how wrong and bad and dirty she was. She was going to a birthday party later that day, so she was dressed up in her pretty birthday party dress. She sat in her birthday party clothes crying and received the shaming excoriation as she thought, I would never say that because I'm all dressed up. When she got home, her mom asked what had happened, and thankfully, mom believed her side of the story. Yet, Nadine told me, there had been a tiny part of me that was curious and wondered what would have happened if I had done it. And that stayed with me for years, like for years. I would feel ashamed if I just felt curious about sex. If I inserted myself into a fantasy, my brain would be like, nope. So I had to insert some kind of avatar for myself in the fantasy. But the shame's interference with her fantasies was not a catalyst for turning toward that ancient shame with curiosity so she could unpack it, discard it. It was only when she saw herself yelling at her young child, just as she was yelled at, that she saw the importance of being curious about it. It was a revelatory, transformational moment, but not in the way you might think. Her whole life wasn't suddenly changed as she instantly shed the old hurt. It wasn't the moment when everything changed. But it was the moment she decided to change everything. She was already working as a child and adolescent sex educator, so you'd think if anyone had the tools and resources to deal with this on her own, it would be Nadine. But no. What she did have was knowledge about how to get the support she needed to do the work that had to be done. So, as many of these stories end, she said to herself, I need to get into therapy. I've heard about breaking cycles, but I don't know how to do that, so I'm going to find a professional. Parenting can trigger old shame and pain, and she didn't want to behave toward her kid in ways that were shaped by hurtful experiences she never chose for herself. That was what motivated her to turn toward her dark places with curiosity. When you come upon a dark place inside yourself, you may have feelings about it before you even begin to explore. You may feel a sense of dread or foreboding, a sense of anxiety and a desire to run or hide, or maybe a hot flare of anger that tells you something dangerous is there. If that's your experience, don't try to push through those uncomfortable feelings. Those uncomfortable feelings are part of the dark place. Rather than push through, breathe through. Stay with the difficult feeling. Turn your attention toward those difficult feelings with, you guessed it, calm, warm curiosity. Confidence is knowing what is true, and that includes knowing the difficult truth that we live in a world where sex may be used as a weapon against a person, and where anyone who doesn't fit the prescribed norm is shamed and punished for their sexuality. P.S. No one fits the prescribed norm. We have all been shamed and punished. That's why we all have dark places. And it's also why some folks are unaware of their dark places. We hide them even from ourselves. And then when something goes wrong in our sexuality, we have no idea why, because everything we can see about our sexuality looks fine. The dark places may be among the most difficult things to know about ourselves and to love. And don't worry about finishing the process of shining a light on all your dark places. You may never get there. You don't have to. Turn toward your dark places with warm curiosity. It will grow easier each time. Trauma, neglect, and abuse. Oh my. As a sex educator, I have some pretty wild fantasies, but maybe not the kind you think. For example, I have a fantasy that one day I'll write a book about sex and not need to include a section on trauma. I'll be able to dwell in all the pleasurable, optimistic, joyful delights available to us through our sexualities. As it is, at least 1 in 3 of the women, 1 in 6 of the men, and half of the trans and non-binary folks listening to this likely have experienced some form of intimate partner or sexual trauma. Trauma isn't limited to a response to an isolated incident like a specific attack. It can also emerge in response to ongoing abuse where someone feels trapped in a relationship, sexual or not. Beyond sexuality itself, neglect can do as much damage as a specific violent attack. Childhood neglect is slippery because it's so easy to tell ourselves stories about how it wasn't neglect, it was autonomy. Our adult caregivers needed to work that much, they were struggling themselves, etc., etc. All of that can be true, while it's simultaneously true that your little body didn't get its needs, including its needs for care, met enough to prevent emotional injuries. About a third of people experience sufficient childhood adversity, including neglect, to significantly impact their health and relationships as adults. That adds up to a large proportion of the population walking around with deep wounds, chronic emotional pain, and related physical health consequences. So here we all are. Hi, everybody. Hello. Me too. Welcome to the biggest party no one wants to be invited to. But it is a party. We're over here shedding the experiences that taught us we didn't deserve to be safe. We're out in the garden folding rich, fertile compost into the barren places where someone hurt us. We're celebrating survival, grieving and raging and rediscovering ourselves together. In literal terms, we're going to therapy, reading books about healing, cultivating loving, trustworthy connections, practicing self-compassion, or, when that's too difficult, compassion for others and for our younger selves. Your experience of trauma, neglect, and/or abuse, TNA for short, probably influenced your emotional floor plan. I don't know what your brain did to survive, but here are a few of the patterns you might notice, though again, everyone's brain is different and reacts in a unique way to TNA. Your care space might have a randomly appearing space-time portal into panic grief, so that anytime you're in care, you could blink and suddenly find yourself in panic grief. Or your care space might have a poorly constructed floorboard that breaks when you step on it and you find yourself plunging into either rage or fear. Recall the diversity of experiences included in that fear space. It's not just running away. It's not even just cowering in a corner, trembling until the threat goes away. It can also be people-pleasing, perfectionism, and a need to keep everyone around you happy at all times, regardless of the cost to yourself. That's a stress response sometimes known as fawn, and it can be a trauma response, too. Fear can also be freeze, a dull, numb, checked-out feeling. I've seen this one appear in people's eyes while I talk to them. They come up and ask a question about a difficult experience they had. I begin to answer in a gentle but frank way, and it's like they depart their own eyeballs. They look like they're listening, but their TNA has grabbed their rational brain, said, nope, and hauled them off into panic grief or a freeze fear response. The ways our brains adapted to TNA are not ways we are broken. They are ways we are survivors. Our emotional floor plans got us through. Maybe some of those TNA adaptations aren't as helpful these days. Maybe we'd prefer to make some changes now that we're not in immediate danger. We get to choose. There are whole books about sex and survivorship, and if your TNA is affecting your sexuality, I hope you'll explore some of them and maybe pursue therapy. But here, I want to offer a specific tip for survivors, which is that sometimes our escapist behaviors are actually part of our healing. Be curious about the metaphors and stories that soothe you. Nothing in our real lives can explain or describe what happens inside us as we heal from trauma. We may need the metaphors of a fantasy world to describe our experience. Take The Lord of the Rings. 1,000 pages of high fantasy plus 2 volumes of mythopoeic stories. People don't reread all that because it's fun to spend that much time with a bunch of white men of different statures. People reread it and memorize ancestries and learn to speak fictional languages because they need somewhere to be that feels the way they feel on the inside. And nowhere real feels like what trauma feels like on the inside. Frodo the Hobbit says, "I will take the ring to Mordor, though I do not know the way." That can be what it feels like to choose to heal from trauma. Every morning when we wake up, we decide to carry this burden another step closer to wherever it can be destroyed, even though we don't know where we're going or how or if we'll get there. Why do people love Samwise Gamgee? Because though he can't carry the ring, he can carry Frodo. He is an ideal co-survivor. He stays no matter how scary it gets. He suffers alongside Frodo, but he never equates his struggle to his friends. You want to know how to help a friend with their trauma or feel what it would be like to have an ideal supporter? Check out Sam, who wants to go home to his Rosie, but he would never abandon Frodo. The best metaphor for my own TNA is Moana, a Disney cartoon musical which I, a 40-something woman, saw 3 times in the theater. When something grabs you so hard you have to see it or read it or listen to it many times, be curious about what that metaphor is doing for you. Moana is called by the ocean to cross the horizon and restore the heart of Te Fiti, a green stone that was stolen from the goddess of life and abundance. For me, the big moment is when Moana confronts her last, worst enemy, the lava monster, Te Ka. When I see Te Ka rise up in fury, my brain goes, "It, me." I'm watching my best self, as Moana, approach the most difficult and damaged parts of me, as Te Ka. And what does Moana do? She notices the swirl on the chest of Te Ka, a swirl that matches the swirl on the heart of Te Fiti. She sees below the surface of Te Ka's rage, and instead of being afraid, she turns toward her. She sings, "They have stolen the heart from inside you, but this does not define you. This is not who you are." She puts the heart of Te Fiti at the center of the swirl on Te Ka's chest. They touch foreheads. They breathe each other's air. And the lava monster transforms into Te Fiti, the goddess of life and abundance. and I stare at the screen, eyes wide, tears dripping down my face into my snack. Why? Because this metaphor explains more accurately than any literal description can what healing feels like for me. Like Moana, I see beneath the surface of my own pain. I turn toward it without fear, with a calm, warm, goddamn curiosity. The pain and I breathe the same air. And the pain transforms into power. Compare that to a literal description of what healing feels like. Traumatic experiences taught my brain that other people and my own internal experiences are not safe. But many people and all of my internal experiences are safe. I teach my brain this by paying gentle attention to uncomfortable emotions as they happen and noticing that I am not unsafe while those emotions happen. Such a literal description begs the question, how do you pay gentle attention? How do you notice you're safe during unsafe feeling emotions? What does it feel like? I can't describe it without a metaphor. It feels like I'm on fire. But also, I am the ocean. And also, I am love. There is no literal description clearer than that. Nothing in our mundane lives can capture the internal experience of healing from trauma, neglect, and abuse. We need stories of magic to talk about healing from trauma, neglect, and abuse. When you escape into a fantasy, maybe you're healing yourself. The importance of processing TNA through fantasy and magical metaphors is why I give whole talks about the parallels between cartoons and the science of emotions and trauma. Not just Moana, but Inside Out, emotion dismissing, Frozen, childhood trauma and neglect, Encanto, intergenerational trauma, Turning Red, bicultural trauma. How does trauma heal? Every day? A miracle happens. That's how. We wake up. We carry the ring. We brush our teeth. We befriend the monster. We live our lives. We talk about Bruno. Yes, go to therapy and practice self-care and connect with trustworthy people. Practice yoga or tai chi or other body-based experiences that feel safe inside your skin. Heal in the real world. And self-soothe in a fictional world where your insides can finally match your outsides. There's a reason our stories are full of magic. It's because we survivors are full of magic. Bodies change with time and experience. Curiosity is often our best, most foolproof tool for approaching these changes. It may not be sufficient, but it's never the wrong place to start. Chapter 7, TLDR. 1. Curiosity is turning toward what's true, regardless of whether it's what you wish were true or were taught should be true, and saying, I see you, I love you, I want to know you. This, rather than turning toward what's happening with fear, rage, or panic grief. 2. Bodies change and vary over time, especially with age, illness, or injury. Our bodies may have new needs that could alter the ways our partners give and receive care in the relationship. As long as you can see your partner as themselves, separate from their needs, you'll maintain a connection that embraces bodies as they are. 3. I don't know one person who didn't absorb sexual shame from somewhere, whether it was from their family, their religion, or popular culture. The more we let ourselves notice the shame and shine a light on what it wants to hide, the more of ourselves we make available for connection and pleasure. 4. A lot of us carry trauma in our bodies. Beyond therapy and safe connection and practices like yoga, many survivors use stories of magic and fantasy to experience and articulate something that approximates survivorship more accurately than anything in our daily lives. Some good questions. In what context is it easy to be in a curious space in my mind? Where does shame live in my body, emotions, or thoughts? Where does it live in my partner? What would happen if we, as our best selves, spoke to each other of our shame? What magic have I developed in response to the trauma, neglect, or abuse I should never have had to endure? What's my superpower? What am I quested to carry? Who is my Samwise? What mythical creatures do my bidding? Am I a mythical creature? Can I visit my deceased ancestors to access their wisdom and love? What calls me?